Coming up on this week's Front Page, we look back at some record breakers at Sandown, give you the latest on affordability checks, and discuss one of the great sporting crossovers. It's all coming up on the Front Page. Hello and a very warm welcome to the Front Page. I'm delighted to say I'm joined this week in the studio by Chris Cook and via the minor miracle of video link by Deputy Industry Editor Pete Scargill to discuss all of the big stories from a busy week in racing. We'll dive straight into it, Chris, with the jumps finale at Sandown and the hoo-ha about the quick ground.
Yeah, it was a hoo-ha. The weather was all against Sandown. You know, they would like to give good ground, which I think it was last year when, you know, unarguably we had some really big names running. But they ended up with good Furman places and you know, trainers, very respectable trainers walking the track and expressing concerns. I think Tom Lacey said, you know, between the fences you'd run any horse, but the takeoffs and landings are getting a bit tight. So he took out Montregard from the big race. John Bond came out, 15 ground related non-runners. It did put a hole in the card. And Sir Anthony McCoy said words to the effect of, I think Good to Firm has no place in the growing description of a grade one racecourse. I think the suggestion was at any time, not just on a big day like this, but particularly on a big day like that. And you totally get his point. In an ideal world, that would not happen. But I think with the temperatures and the kind of dry spell that Sandown had been facing, there's only so much you can do to fight nature. And then, of course, I suppose they are in the awkward position of having to think about what's to come, you know, if they throw in a ton of water to suit jumpers. And meanwhile, they had flat racing on Friday and more flat racing to come, you know, including some really important stuff. So I'm sure that Sandown, with the greatly respected Andrew Cooper, did, you know, all that they could, all that could reasonably be done in the circumstances. And it ended up just a bit too quick. It does happen sometimes. It's probably worth saying on behalf of, you know, all the old timers like myself, this fixture, you know, quite commonly used to get, you know, purely Good to Firm going. And you'd have races like when Desert Orchid won the Whitbread, as it was, or Mr. Frisk won it the year after that, I think. You know, it would be really lively ground, you know, ground that you probably wouldn't ever encounter nowadays in steeplechasing. But I suppose the thinking is that because all the chasers these days are, they gallop at home on all weather surfaces, they're just not conditioned for that kind of surface. Trainers certainly aren't used to running horses on that, you know, on a really lively surface, not their best horses. They're always thinking about what's to come. And so people are, I think, a lot more cautious than they ever used to be. The culture has definitely changed.
Yeah, absolutely. And Pete, did you have sympathy for Andrew Cooper? There's always that thing where they summon the clerk of the course to speak before the TV cameras and they sort of throw their arms in the air a little bit, understandably, and say, well, we can't fight the weather, ultimately.
Well, absolutely. And I think, didn't Andrew Cooper say they'd had 1 millimetre of rain in April this year? I mean, we all know that we're going through a very dry spell in the south at the moment. It's quite remarkable, really, given how much rain we had over the winter, to think that now, you know, we haven't had any rain for a period of time. But that's, you know, that's a changing pattern of weather that people are having to deal with. Perhaps as this becomes more commonplace, people will find abilities and strategies to adapt to it. But I think Chris summed it up well. There's not a lot more I can add to it, really. Andrew Cooper's been doing that job for a long time. He'd have known that in an ideal world, the ground would have been slightly different. But, you know, you can't be overly critical given the circumstances, I think, on this occasion.
And Pete, is there an argument, you know, should we be running a major jumps meeting like this, the finale? It's supposed to be the big dance at the end of the season where we crown champions. There's a lot of excitement and build-up. Should we be running that meeting right at the end of April? Is there an argument that we should perhaps move it forward a little bit? I know Punchestown doesn't seem to have too many problems running a big festival at the end of the season.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the difficulty is where you would move it to. Obviously, it's a relatively busy end to the season after Aintree running to this meeting. I think you've obviously, Chris, identified correctly, you've got flat racing not only as part of this meeting in one sense, but also going on through the summer, whereas Punchestown, I know they have flat racing there, but it's a slightly different dynamic preparing for that big meeting. You know, again, it's almost learning to adapt to the conditions and finding better ways around that, I think, rather than moving what's been established in the calendar for quite a long time. I think we'll have to be more adaptable in, with what's in front of us rather than ripping up what's what we've had sort of thing.
I mean, it's a different climate, isn't it, in Nace compared to Esher?
Yeah.
And that has to be taken into account. I'm interested in the idea of sort of moving everything back a week or two, you know, in the jump season, maybe just to acknowledge the fact that, you know, we think the climate is changing. It does seem to be. You know, maybe it doesn't make much sense to be sort of fighting against conditions at this time of year. You know, even though they can get to good going some years, it takes a big effort. You know, would things be easier if we tried shifting everything back? And you know, then maybe you could bring the link in a bit later and, you know, try and get a little bit more clarity as to when the jump season is ending and the flat season is starting up. There might be some room for manoeuvre there. I don't know if Easter is going to muck things up, as it always does in these calculations, but it'd be worth looking at.
Yeah, it's always worth looking at. And I was interested on to get your thoughts on that meeting generally. I was reading today's front run of with interest. Yeah. You didn't seem particularly enthused.
Well, I mean, the thing that I really noticed, even before all the non-runners, was that, you know, a lack in the depth of the quality compared to, you know, that's been a really big day for the last 2 years because, of course, the trainers' title race came down to the very last day. You had, you know, Dan Skelton desperately trying to win it for the first time, but Willie Mullins, you know, eventually prevailing for both of the last 2 years. And in order to do that, he brought over horses that he would otherwise have been running at Punchestown. You know, last year, we got the benefit of Bloomin' Gallic Warrior turning up in the Oaksy Chase. And Ilete Tom won. Kitzbühel was placed in a hurdle race last year. So, you know, those are three horses that went on to win grade ones at this year's Cheltenham Festival. And I think he had 21 runners in total, Willie, on that day last year. You know, he really added to the quality of the day. And then this year, because he can't possibly win, he has the one runner in the Bet365, which ran really well. I got beaten less than a length, I think. But that's it. And so, you know, when he doesn't come over with his big guns, you know, I was sort of opening the Racing Post in the morning and sort of going, gosh, these races are not as deep as I remember them being in the past. Of course, part of that will be because trainers knew they were going to get quick ground. But there's that, you know, I think there's significant concern about whether, you know, British racing left to its own devices without Irish assistance can properly stock a day's racing like that at the end of term when we want it to be really quality racing. You know, do we have the guns in this country? It's something that maybe Dan Skelton, you know, with his increasing power, is working towards, you know, getting hold of that kind of calibre of horse, but it hasn't happened yet.
No, seamless segue on to Dan Skelton, obviously crown champion trainer for the first time and went through the £5 million mark for the season. How do you reflect on that achievement?
Yeah, I mean, well, so the context is that no one's ever got to £4 million before. And, you know, when you compare it to his main competitors in this country, I'm sure it was said in the paper, he had twice as many winners and he had more winners than Nicky Henderson and Paul Nicholls put together, more runners than both of them put together. And as you say, that extraordinary total of prize money. I don't have the impression from what he was saying that he's going to go all out to sort of break that prize money record again in the future. You know, this was a particular effort aimed at, you know, warding off Willie before we get to Sandown, saying, look, it's mine. Stay there.
Yeah,
don't come over here.
and
it worked, you know. He absolutely romped it after 2 years of frustration. So an astonishing effort, which has taken, a huge quantity of horsepower. And God knows what in the way of effort at his yard. I thought it was a really pleasing detail that he got a bus to take 60 of his staff to Sandown on Saturday. Apparently they were all, you know, half cut and singing Sweet Caroline on the way down. I'm not saying you would have wanted to be there necessarily, you know, once you get past the age of 50, maybe. But it sounds like they had a great time. And it's, you know, it's a really great detail that he sort of took that care of the people who've helped him to get over the line. As to what future season will be like, you know, he's going to be very hard to beat by anyone in this country. But I have the impression, and I wish that he would sort of slightly switch the focus from quantity to quality. And there's always that sort of thing in your mind, because I think a lot of his success this season was based on handicaps. he's always been able to win major handicaps, but that is harder to sustain than getting hold of a really good horse that's just going to win his division, you know, year after year. So, you know, if he can get his hands on, you know, one or two of those horses that, that Willie always seems to have, you know, that would be interesting, and it would be great to have that, you know, kind of horse back here in Britain again.
I suppose, Pete, that's sort of the next step, isn't it? He's got the numbers. He has a lot of quality horses, clearly. But I suppose the step up to Willie Mullins is you're winning championships and also mopping up championship races. And I suppose that's probably the focus now for Skelton, will be getting in those real high-class horses. I mean, the new Lion we thought potentially could be one. But, you know, the likes of Gaelic Warrior that Mullins has, those real top draw horses. Is that where you think he should be sort of focusing from now on?
It seems that has to be the way. And, you know, you look at the piece that Keith did, Keith Melrose, our betting editor, did on Friday, I think it was, we talked about how Skelton had got more out of his better horses this year by being very canny with his placements. But if he has these quality horses coming through like Mullins every year, that's, you know, it's not going to require that level of skill to an extent, because you can just target the good horses at the good races. So that's got to be one thing. And seemingly he's got his eyes set on trying to break Martin Pipe's number of winners in a season record as well. So it would suggest those two things are probably quite foremost in his mind.
And Chris, it was an interesting moment, him being handed the trophy by Paul Nicholls, who was so dominant for so long and did have that sort of, for a long time, had the high-class horses and the quantity of those sort of big race wins.
Yeah.
Are we looking at another sort of Nicholls-esque period of domination, do you think, from Skelton? You mentioned it would probably be Willie Mullins will be his main competitor next year. Is there any suggestion there?
That's how it looks now. I mean, the game is always evolving, right? And you have to open up your mind to the possibility of, you know, trainers and stables just becoming more powerful over time. You know, Ollie Murphy is getting very big. And so, you know, there's two or three others that you think, well, you know, they could put themselves in a position to at least challenge to get into the conversation, which is healthy. You know, a little bit of flux and development, you know, that's good for the game. You don't want the same thing year after year. But he, you know, he's definitely well placed to be the headline act for the next 5 years here, at least.
Yeah, and I think Ollie Murphy was sort of identified as a possible challenger, certainly numerically. I think Paul Nicholls might have even mentioned Ollie Murphy as one who could. Nicholls doesn't have the same numbers as he once had. Helped, no doubt, by Sean Bowen being able to call on him, Ollie Murphy, and he was crowned champion jockey again. He has his eyes set on Sir E.P. McCoy's record for number of winners in a season. Do you think that's achievable for him, Pete, the way he's riding at the moment?
It's obviously more difficult now that you can't ride at two meetings in a day, as you could have done in McCoy's time. But, I mean, his ability to get horses to win, I mean, how many times this season have we watched the horse win and gone, God, how did Sean Bowen get that down? I mean, that's an amazing trait and a desire to get winners. I mean, he has a real passion for riding winners anywhere, anytime. So having that drive can't help but give him an opportunity to get to that number. And obviously the more your reputation builds and the more you develop you know, a reputation for being able to get anything to win any time, almost, you're going to get more outside rides, so you've got that backing of a big yard like Ollie Murphy, but he's going to be the go-to man for lots of other people as well. So I mean, why not? Why shouldn't he set himself that challenge, and why shouldn't he go for it? I think it'll be, you know, a real good addition to the season, and hopefully, like a bit like we've been talking about with Dan Scales, and he'll want more big winners as well as part of that. I mean, the numbers are important to him, but he'll want more big winners. He'll want more days like he had with Haiti Galore as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. It wouldn't surprise me at all if the same people were on the podium this time next year.
At least next year.
And possibly even the year after, it's going.
Then maybe it's up for discussion. I mean, the Sean Bowen thing, you know, just aiming at bigger numbers every time, I slightly regret that sort of the implication that the best thing you can do as a jockey is win more and more. And as we get that from Sir Anthony, obviously. But you always have that option to keep yourself fresh for the big days, to hone your talent, to work on your association with particular horses. You know, you don't have to be sending yourself to Perth or Worcester every day, you know, at risk of getting an injury, you know, in a low quality race when you're going to be needed on the Saturday. You know, there's another way to go. It doesn't have to be about, you know, six rides every day.
The old Frankie Dettori selective approach towards the end.
Well, not just towards the end with him, I think, for much of his career. Yeah, I don't see Sean Bowen leaning that. He's not going to be a Frankie Dettori anytime soon. In terms of his approach to the game, he's got too much desire for that. But yeah, you know, I don't want the game to eat him up alive. That's what I'm saying. You know, he's allowed a break every so often.
Mm. And he clearly loves the game. He loves riding winners. And so, too, another one who loves the game, in another seamless segue, Edward Stone. Obviously, the race
right.
marred by the loss of Thistleask, which did put a real dampener on the day, certainly for the Skelton team. But we do also have to celebrate Edward Stone winning a race like that at his advanced age.
It's terrific stuff. I mean, so he's 12 years old. I think it's 3.5 years since he last won a Grade One, which would have been the Tingle Creek over the same course and distance. And, you know, he's been such a trier. There's been a couple of times when I thought he was slightly unlucky along the way. I think he got unsighted, and one time that he fell around Sandown. You know, a really brave horse, really durable talent, and he's, you know, he's just not quite good enough when he's been running into one or two particular horses. But you know, it never took any edge off his enthusiasm. And you hear Alan King talking about, you know, how he's the same horse in the gallops as he ever was, you know, which is not all that common. You know, these races must be hard work for him, punishing sometimes. And so, it's great to see him come out on top again. You know, dreadful about Thistleask. You know, and as you say, that obviously cast a dampener on the Dan Skelton camp. But, you know, horses like Edward Stone, who've been around forever, are a big part of what keeps sort of jump racing fans, you know, close to the game.
And were any other highlights for you, Pete, from the day, or indeed the flat card the day before, perhaps?
Yeah, I think probably my focus would have been more on the Friday racing, given my biases. You know, the Opera Ballet winning the Bet365 Mile, a race that you know, we all rather bigged up beforehand as like a mini Lockinge, effectively. A very clever ride from the front on William Buick on a horse who's not necessarily a front runner. He's going to head to France next time, by lots of things, for the Prix Aga Khan, where he could meet Darras, which is a tantalising thought given his performance yesterday as well. Thought Field of Gold ran a respectable prep. I mean, I did see his reporters having bled afterwards, but it didn't look like a performance of a horse who sort of bleeding has affected them. There might have been something else that caused that. So it was a good performance, and it's teed it up for a couple of other exciting races down the road as well, in the Lockinge and the Prix Aga Khan. I was also thought Rahib for Owen Burrows in the Classic Trial, very interesting performance from him, sort of building up to Classic potentially, but almost a little bit like the 2000 Guineas we've got coming this weekend, when we're not sure who's going to turn up still. Or, you know, we've been having horses dropping out left, right and centre. And Burrows was sort of quite keen to play down a potential tilt at the Derby. So I hope people Graft and Nestle want to run in these races a little bit more than just thinking about the future all the time.
And Pete, given your biases, we'll stick with you for some more flat stuff, if I may. Darras, very impressive, sort of coming out of his post-arc hibernation. It's a race you would have expected him to win, but he still had to go and win it. And it looks like Royal Ascot might be on the agenda, which is very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely was a race that he should have won, although watching it and reading Scott Burton's sort of reports analysis, there's a lot of positives to take away in terms of how the horse behaved himself, how he's matured. He's still a very lightly raced, inexperienced horse, so he's clearly learning, which is helping, getting better. The prospect of him coming over to Royal Ascot, obviously very exciting, having met Opera Ballo on the way. You know, these are the sort of clashes we want to be seeing with these good horses. And I mean, Francis Graffard, who had this astonishing year last year with the number of Group 1 winners he had, performances all over the globe. You know, he's got the best horse in the world, Calandagan, he's looking to dominate in these middle distance races, mile and a half races, and now he's got an arc winner who seemingly has the speed and the talent to drop into mile and a quarter races. So it looks like he's going to be as formidable as ever this season, Graffard.
Yeah, well, the boy from Burgundy, as I dubbed him in a piece
like
around
that
arc time.
It's interesting, he's becoming quite an Anglophile, isn't he? He kept bringing Calandagan to Britain. to race, and now here's Darragh being aimed at Royal Ascot. You know, we're very lucky because he's obviously the coming man in France. So he's fully arrived, hasn't he? He's the now the dominant power there. And when he gets horses like, you know, Darragh coming along, from the support that he gets from the Aga Khan studs, it's brilliant to think that, you know, he'll be bringing those horses to us in the middle of the summer.
And the Aga Khan, I mean, we love dubbing these owners as superpowers, but it does feel as though they have such strength and depth this season. You know, are they going to be able to regularly keep taking it to Ballydoyle and the like? It feels as though they can.
Well, you know, great if they can. I think the history of that operation was always that, you know, that you peaks and troughs, but they always stuck by what they were doing. And those, you know, really long-standing bloodlines that they relied on would always come good in the end. And they never sold out for speed. So, you know, I always enjoy seeing, you know, the green colours doing well.
Yes, iconic. On the subject of speed, Kaiying Rising. Another track record, 20th win in a row. Are we looking at the best sprinter of all time, potentially, or am I getting overly excited?
He could be. It's slightly hard to measure because his success is still sort of restricted to one part of the world. You know, if he wants to be known as the best in the world, he needs to...
Come to Royal Ascot. Come to,
Ascot would be great. You know, Europe anyway, you know, or America. You know, spread his wings a little bit, but I mean, he does look properly amazing. He beat the Japanese horse that was at Royal Ascot last summer and ran second in the six
second.
Furlong race. So yeah, I mean, you know, if you can just take that form literally, he'd beat everything just now that could possibly put up against him. I haven't heard any mention of Royal Ascot though. You know, I think that they're having a break and going to the Everest in Australia.
Yeah, the Everest is the big one. They're sort of, he's a bit of a prize fighter now, Kaiying Rising. I think they just go where the big money is. A little bit like Romantic Warrior, and why wouldn't you?
I mean, money is a key motivator, I'm told. Not for racing journalists, you know,
course,
we do it for love.
We're in the wrong game.
But yeah, with, you know, flat race horses, it's bound to be that way, and that of course makes us vulnerable. You know, you're always reliant when it comes to Royal Ascot on people wanting to come for this particular stage and show off. But they're not here for the Benjamins.
And Pete, I come to you for a final word on Hong Kong, Kaiying Rising, Romantic Warrior, My Wish, sort of the big three, all winning the Group Ones. Is that a case of the international competition not being quite so strong, or is it simply Hong Kong has some of the best horses in the world right now?
Well, in Kaiying Rising and Romantic Warrior, I mean, you'd perhaps know better than I would, John, given you've seen them in the flesh. They're clearly outstanding horses who perform regularly to an outstanding level under those conditions you have at Sha Tin. I mean, the fact that Kaiying Rising was able to break the track record, given that they'd said, we're not going to bother trying to break a track record this week, sort of shows you how dominant and how much of a force he is in that division. I mean, it falls at a slightly funny time of year for European horses in particular, isn't it? I mean, end of April, start of May, we're gearing up for racing over here predominantly rather than looking elsewhere. So maybe that lessens the competition. Although Docklands ran and ran quite well behind My Wish. So, you know, he's an example of what can be done if you have the right sort of horse and the right sort of ambition. But it's, you know, with talking, just going back to Kaiying Rising, Chris, you said you hadn't seen anything about Ascot. I think our colleague Maddie Player had spoken with David Hayes and effectively said, look, if you guys put up all the incentives for us to come, we'll consider it. But ultimately, they don't feel they need to justify his brilliance by coming over and campaigning him over here. So
is that
probably a lost cause, frankly. But I say, I mean, John, I don't know what your view on those two in particular is, given you saw them in December.
Well, Kaiying Rising essentially won in December, eased down from what felt like a furlong out, essentially cantered home.
Amazing.
There is that real feeling watching it of this is something special, but also slight regret that they don't just go, let's just really let him extend and go for it. Let's try and shatter the track record, not just beat it sort of incrementally. And Romantic Warriors similarly almost feels inevitable with him that he's going to, he never runs a bad race, even finishing second in a Saudi Cup was an enormous run. He just feels as though he's always going to win. He's so reliable. Obviously a massive earner for his connections as well. So I think, two of the sort of top five horses in the world comfortably. It's just what order you put them in. I know there's a little bit of debate about Calandagan versus Kaiying Rising for world's best racehorse. I think narrowly for me, Calandagan, simply because of where he did it and how he did it. But Kaiying Rising's got to be bang there as one of the best horses in the world, I would say.
You're slightly comparing apples and oranges, aren't you?
Well, this is it. Yeah, it's one of those. How do you possibly... It's like comparing a goalkeeper to a striker, isn't it, for the player, world's best player? Like,
100%.
Two completely different disciplines, essentially. But two very exciting horses. We'll stick to the flat and talk about a rather thorny issue now, certainly one that's picked up a fair bit of traction on social media, Chris, barrier trials.
Oh, good, barrier
slightly
trials, what fun.
Crept up on us a little bit as an
issue.
Well,
it's sort of caught fire on social media over time, I think. Because horses would win races that hadn't run, or you thought they hadn't run, and then, you know, word would seep out that this was one that had won one of those barrier trials or had showed up really well in one of them. You know, whether it would be connections saying that or people saying, you know, punters saying, oh, I backed this thing because it won the barrier trial the other day. And, you know, that happens enough times, and it becomes a talking point. So the discussion now seems to be, should we know more about these? You know, should the results be published? Should we be able to watch them live as they happen? They're organised by a private company, but they take place on licensed racecourses, and of course they involve, you know, racehorses from licensed racing stables, often with jockeys, like, you know, professional jockeys rather than just work riders. So it feels appropriate to argue the case for you know, public access. It is always regrettable, I think, when you put the betting public in the position of getting turned upside down by a very small number of people with inside information of something significant like that. I mean, this is why we declare wind operations, for example. You know, we always, the idea is to try and put the betting public in the picture as much as possible so that afterwards they don't feel that they've been blindsided. And if the BHA wants to have a long-running and successful sport with the broad support of the public, then they do obviously need to bring some transparency to this area as well. But you're slightly pulling at a difficult thread, because there have always been racecourse gallops, and you know, for as long as I can remember, and you hardly ever hear about those until after the event.
Do we start publishing those results? Do we start publishing the results of how they worked?
Just letting people know that they happen, but I mean, of course, that won't happen, because it's a really difficult subject. Most racecourses only have so much scope to accept gallopers, because, you know, it's extra work for the turf. And they want to do favours for the trainers around the area that support them. But other people are always asking, and they have to say no to a lot of people. And so then if it seeps out that so-and-so was allowed to gallop a horse in your race course, but you said no to this guy, then you end up getting a lot of heat. And that's why race courses much prefer to do that kind of thing on the quiet. If you're going to make a big deal out of publicising barrier trials, you know, do you not also have to do that for all kinds of, you know, anything that happens on the race course involving preparation of horses for races?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, Pete. I think with the barrier trials, there is a precedent, isn't there, in other racing jurisdictions to almost formalise those, and then perhaps race course gallops, and obviously the more extreme examples, that's a little bit more ad hoc. But something where you have the data, it seems you also have the footage. I'm struggling myself to see a reason, you might be able to tell me one, why they aren't being publicised, why those results aren't widely available. And then I suppose the follow-up question is, who should be paying for them? Who should be funding them?
Well, in some countries, it's required that horses have barrier trials before they race. They have to have had some kind of jump-out experience, which then, if that is part of the rules, then it would make sense that information is public. In Ireland, I was having a look before this started, it actually seems to fall under the banner of Irish Thoroughbred Marketing, which is quite interesting if you think about what's trying to be shown here to the public. You know, they're aware that it's something that the public would be interested in knowing. Over here, I mean, I've had a horse participate in a barrier trial in the past. She went and she won first time out, coincidentally. She won very comfortably first time out. Now, we thought she was, and she was a talented filly. And we wanted to add that sort of race course experience to her preparation before we went. So, I mean, I think the difference perhaps with barrier trials and a racecourse gallop, for example, is obviously with a racecourse gallop, it's in-house, you know, it's a horse and a, you know, horses, I should say, from the same yard, and they know what they're doing. Whereas in a barrier trial, you have the experience of not only the race course, but, you know, stalls and other horses from other yards, all with different objectives. I mean, there'll be some people wanting to go and win a barrier trial, and there'll be some people who just want their horse to have that experience of the rough and tumble and what is going to be expected of them on a race day. And if that's the case, you can understand why people would want that information. And I'm sort of with you, really, John. It's hard to think there's no reason to give it. Because it is. I mean, particularly with two-year-olds, think how many times we've seen two-year-olds messing around at the gate, not knowing what's going on, that, you know, calling out and shouting in the paddock and all of that sort of stuff. Having been there and having seen it and having experienced something clearly is advantageous to the horse. And I'm sure there are horses who've participated in barrier trials that haven't won as well. But that should be information that people are allowed to see and use rather than it becoming public afterwards. In terms of funding, it's slightly difficult as well. I mean, for example, if the BHA were to put it on and people were to pay to get involved, would there need to be a certain number of horses that go? I mean, I think these private ones, if they don't get the right number of horses, they don't take part. If the BHA are doing that and you're not getting horses take part in one, so it's cancelled, but they're taking part in others, is that tricky as a governing body to be responsible for ones that do and don't take place? Are you at more of an advantage if you're involved in one that's got 10 runners or one that's involved that's got three? I'm not sure I've got an answer to you off the top of my head for that one, but I think if you make the information public as a starting point, as a sort of a necessity of them taking place, maybe it can then come under central umbrella if that is proving to be effective for people.
Or we could find a sponsor. Have the Jet 2 Holidays Barrier Trials.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe.
I'm just thinking about the whole idea of requiring them before you go to the races. It's sort of, are you taking away a run? You know, would that normally be, in a lot of cases, a horse taking part in a formal race? You don't want to be taking away from your actual sport for the sake of these things.
Yeah, it's challenging. I thought we'd nearly solved it.
Sorry.
We came so close to solving it.
I don't know. It's really difficult because, Pete, I don't know if you agree with me. I was sort of thinking that publishing the results probably wouldn't be all that helpful unless you're going to have, you know, particular weights carried by all the horses, and, you know, so then you need a clerk of the scales there and somebody regulating all of that, which you probably don't. I was thinking, you know, the helpful thing would be if they were just filmed and the footage is put online and you're told who's there, and then just leave it at that. Would that make any sense to you? Would you see some credible advantage in that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely got to be the case. I mean, like I said, it's not a race. I mean, that's the important thing to remember.
Sure.
You know, there's no prize money. There's no betting on it. So there'll be people there who want to go and win because, you know, they think it'd be advantageous to their horse's preparation. And maybe the owners will like it that their horse went to a barrier trial and has already beaten 10 other horses.
I bet it would be exciting, yeah. You go, what's
exactly
going to happen
now? But if you're, but if there's a, you know, people are going there with different objectives and horses who are different readiness, by being able to view it, you can see which horses are being scrubbed along, whereas you can see which other horses are just, you know, getting in a bit of trouble, going this way, getting used to it. It's a little bit, you know, with the breeze ups, obviously all the breeze up sales are recorded and you can watch them online with the sales companies. And you can see which horses are being driven out over the last furlong or the run out, or the horses that have had an easier time, the horses that are running around. It'd almost be along that sort of line. You can see it and you can see the differences between how people are going on rather than just seeing a list of numbers and times. You know, if you just got the times from the breeze up sales, you'd probably go, well, obviously you buy the horse that's just done the fastest time because it's, you know, they're in front of you. And if you've got the money to do it, then that's great. But, you know, the nuances of what's going on with these things is important to understand as much as anything, because, say, there might be horses that win barrier trials and to some extent they've left their race behind.
That's their gold cup, as it turns out.
Mm.
Pete used the word nuances there. We had a fairly non-nuanced view from the Transport Minister, of all people, on affordability checks.
I tell you what.
Last week, saying
this is the best show ever for segues.
Thank you. I put a lot of work into it. It doesn't just happen, Chris. This
is that Lee Waterhead, he knows nothing compared to you.
Please do tell him that the next time you see him. We had the Transport Minister discussing, at the end of a debate on gambling advertising, saying that the essentially affordability checks were widely supported. Now, that, looking at your facial expression, that just doesn't really tally with what we're hearing, what a lot of people are hearing. Is this just another example, perhaps, of the disconnect between the government and the actual reality of the situation on what is, whichever way you look at it, a fairly complicated and nuanced situation?
Widely supported depends very much on who you're talking to, which audience you're aiming at. I was sort of left with the impression that she's thinking about people who are worried about gambling, anti-gambling campaigners, the people who are sort of raising all kinds of concerns about, it needs to be clamped down on and people are suffering and so on. If you talk to anybody who's involved in the industry or anyone who's involved in horse racing, you'd obviously get a completely different view. And what was so disappointing about this was, we did think from the trend of the recent conversation that message was getting across and was being heard. And here instead you get this sort of completely tone-deaf response from government, indicating that they've evidently learned nothing from everything that's been said in recent times. And in fact, we're not going to be protected from the impact of affordability checks. And it's going to continue to be very hard times for the betting industry. Desperate that, she was speaking, the Transport Minister, rather than anyone from the DCMS, which is the actual department responsible. Maybe they're, so embarrassed or so unsure of their position that, none of them actually wanted to front up and do this job. But either way, it's a sad story.
And Pete, what was your read on that situation?
Well, we're thundering towards this board meeting of the Gambling Commission next month, where there's a very large possibility that these affordability checks may be signed into, given the sign-off to go ahead. And there seems to have been this assumption that's built within government and within the Gambling Commission that what's going on at the moment isn't sort of real affordability checks, financial risk checks, and when, we've done this pilot and the pilot's actually really good despite what people are saying, and this stuff that will be signing will give everyone clarity, and we've done a year's worth of pilot, we've spent years getting this ready, and once it's all in place everything will be fine. And it's an assumption that we're having difficulty seemingly moving people's minds on, and I don't see why that could be the case when you see so many examples of so many people of authority speaking out against them. I mean, to go back to James Noyes, who's campaigns to bring these things, even he's saying, look, these things don't produce consistent results. You've got to pause them and think about it. Whereas they seem to think, if we just carry on regardless, we'll get the outcome we want. So that assumption that's been borne out is very troubling in terms of the effectiveness of these checks. I mean, I was speaking to one punter last week who says he knows when one's coming now. He can sense when one's coming because of how his gambling's been, even though his gambling's well in control and this is not problematic. He knows the triggers that are coming in, and he has suffered through this because he wants to carry on, but he finds it incredibly distasteful that he has to do it. And he's actually taken to sort of copying and pasting his correspondence between different bookmakers. They don't accept it. He's saying that this is ridiculous. I'm having this from all of you all of the time. Even though I've been through it with you all of the, with you multiple times, I'm still getting triggered on this. How is that frictionless? How is that, doing what these checks are supposed to be doing? It's not. It's unnecessary intervention, and it's just being ignored. It's just being overlooked because it's got to come in. It's got to come in the new system because we worked so hard on it. So there needs to be engagement. There needs to be people with open ears. I mean, it's what Grant Dunshay, the BHA chief executive, was saying recently. He's talked about his frustration. And you can understand, reading what's been put out by the Gambling Commission and what was said in this Westminster Hall debate, why that frustration is so high, because it's tone deaf, it's cloth eared at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think we want to avoid a situation where we have policy for policy's sake, where you just sort of persevere with something because we put all this work into it, we've done the pilots, well, we have to see it through to the end, whatever that looks like. I think there would be a great deal of respect for a department or an organisation, or in this case, the Gambling Commission, that just holds its hand up and goes, that wasn't wasted effort because now we have all this data, we understand it a bit more,
yeah.
But we're not going to press on regardless. We'll just sit with it for a moment and see, because clearly, from what we're hearing, it just isn't working in its current guise.
We would respect them for that, but I guess what they're afraid of is all of those people who are, again, as I say, worried about the impact of problem gambling, would holler and shriek if there was any kind of delay, and that I think is what those in government are most worried about just now. And they can't seem to be steered away from that. But there was a study reported last week that said in 2 years' time, advertising aimed at British gamblers from black market firms is going to exceed, in terms of the amount of money spent on it, the advertising from legitimate firms that are regulated. That, to me, sort of is a really clear sign that we're heading in a dreadful direction. People are being chased out of a market where there are measures in place for their protection towards another market where there are no such measures. And terrible things can happen. That ought to be the reason why, as you say. Government should pause and think again. But there's no sign of it.
No sign of it. A big few weeks on the affordability front, which we'll be covering in great detail during that time. I don't want to leave you on a bad news story, and I don't want to leave Chris without one final segue. So from affordability checks,
here we
go to checkouts news that Luke Littler has bought into a horse called Bunting Mental with his darts competitor, friend, yeah, Stephen Bunting.
Sure, friend and sometime rival.
A great
rival.
Sporting crossover with Hugo Palmer, Michael Owen. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, it's terrific, anytime we can show some new audience out there that racing is fun, then it's just great stuff. Luke Littler, I don't follow darts, but he seems to be enormously popular. I think he's still only 19 years old. He's been world champion 2 years in a row, already earning millions from prize money and sponsorship. And he loves racing, God bless him. He made quite a big splash at the Cheltenham Festival, turned up there 3 days in a row, won big on King Rasco Grey, I think it was. Put the betting slip on Instagram. He's doing GBR's job for them, Great British Racing, projecting the game and telling people to come along and go racing. So good on him for being involved in a horse, and I hope it's not the last one. Sad to hear, I think this one in question's had a little setback, but going to be running in a couple of months anyway. I'm sure Hugo will look after him.
Yeah, and Pete, just on that, it's got to be good as a sort of marketing tool, hasn't it? Harry Redknapp and the Jukebox Man being the main example, but we've had Brooks Koepka's had shares in horses. Can you see? I'm struggling to see if there's anything we can be miserable about with this story. It feels as though it is just a good news story, and it has to be good in terms of the sort of wider coverage that it generates.
Of course it does, and you know yourself that as soon as there is a name attached to a horse or an operation that's known outside of horse racing, it's going to generate more interest than if it's a purely inside the game gig. I mean, I was at Newmarket recently when Michael Owen was down there being filmed by as for part of his Amazon documentary. He's really got into this additional promotion of bringing other people in aspect of what's going on. So, give people more insights and let more people see what there is to offer. I can't be anything but positive, John, I'm afraid. If I'm afraid, I say, I should be afraid,
Don't be afraid of that. Don't never be afraid of being positive. And on that note, I think we'll leave it there before we segue onto anything negative after that. All that's left for me to do is say a big thank you to Chris for joining me in the studio, to Pete for his thoughts via video link, and to you at home for listening and watching. Be sure to tune in next week, and thank you very much.